week of January 24th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 39, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Park City, Utah, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, outside the new Apple store on Broadway and 65th Street, in line to be the first to buy the iPad, I'm Michael Giltz.
It's awfully quiet for New York.
I'm the only one in line, so, you know.
Well, I'm pulling a Michael Giltz this week. I'm actually in Park City, Utah at the Sundance Film Festival, which we'll talk about a little later. But I am recording from Shea Betty, which is one of the four-star restaurants up here in Park City, Utah. There are very few of them. I can afford to record here. I can't afford to eat here because it's a beautiful restaurant, and it's in the building in which I'm staying, and they're allowing me to use their internet to record this week's podcast. So thank you, Shea Betty.
And do you have to wear a coat and tie in order to podcast from their restaurant?
No, not at all.
No. Okay, good.
Do they have a website so we can give them a shout-out?
Yes, as a matter of fact, they do. www.shaybetty.com.
Well done.
Well, Sperling, you're at Sundance watching new movies, but of course, first we should talk about the movies that are already out in the theaters. Number one for this week, of course, is Avatar, which made another $36 million. It's grossed $552 million in the U.S. It's passed The Dark Knight. It's zeroing in on Titanic in the U.S. Overseas, it's grossed more than Titanic. And worldwide, it's just a couple weeks away from being the top grossing film of all time. No end is in sight whatsoever for that. It's unbelievable. Number two is Legion, the Paul Bettany film in which he stars as an angel sent down to protect a new child. It grossed $18 million. Number three is The Book of Eli, the Denzel Washington film, another movie that's sort of religious themed. That proves the power of a movie star. Denzel, it's grossed $17 million. It's at $62 million total, and nobody liked it. And number four is The Tooth Fairy with Dwayne The Rock Johnson, which opened at $14 million, which is kind of soft for a Dwayne The Rock Johnson family film, which usually opened in the mid-20s.
And you can't handle the tooth.
Oh, God. Is that in the movie? I bet it is. And at number five is The Lovely Bones, the Peter Jackson film, which got an okay opening wide, even though it's gotten terrible reviews. It plummeted pretty strongly, almost 50%. It's at $8 million. It's at $32 million total. And it's probably not long for this world. And in the other movies, Harrison Ford's movie Extraordinary Measures opened very weakly. It's the first film from a new division of the network CBS. That grossed $7 million. Alvin the Chipmunks passed $200 million. Sherlock Holmes is almost there. It's at $191 million. Meryl Streep's movie, It's Complicated, is inches away from $100 million. And in limited opening was To Save a Life, which grossed $1.4 million on just a few screens.
Well, now, Michael, you said that, of course, Avatar came in first place, but that's not necessarily a given. I mean, it is in its sixth week, and it had the best sixth week of any film in history.
That's true. It's setting massive records. It grossed twice as much as the number two film, Legion. I said it, of course, because it's such a steamroller, and nothing has seemed even remotely like it might knock it off. Next week, maybe the Mel Gibson movie will have a chance.
But
I don't know.
I
don't. Yeah, I don't think so. I think it's going
to. Nobody cares about Mel Gibson anymore.
Well, we'll find out. But
you know, I want to put a moratorium on Avatar because I'm really kind of bored of talking about it. But I do want to point out one thing, that when you adjust for inflation, that Avatar
is
wait.
Are you going to talk about Avatar? You want to not talk about Avatar, but you're going to.
Well, I want to talk about it in terms of something that I think is much more interesting rather than, ooh, it's on its sixth week, which I really don't care about.
Okay.
I want to talk about the fact that everyone says that this is going to be the top grossing movie of all time, but when you adjust for inflation, it's not.
Actually, it's number 34 when you adjust for inflation, and Gone with the Wind at $1.49 billion is the top domestic earner.
Right. So where are we getting off claiming that Avatar is going to be the highest grossing movie of all time?
Well, because I mean, we're pure dollar numbers are a good measure. You know, you can't compare the 30s to the 60s to the 90s. It's a different era. When there's so many different factors that go into play, movies didn't have TV or radio really competing with them. And the only really fair measurement is actual tickets sold. And it's really impossible to get a good measure of how many tickets these movies have sold throughout the decades. We can only go back, I think, to the late 80s or early 90s for actual tickets sold, which is the best measurement of a movie's success, I think.
Okay, well then why are we even getting a number that Gone with the Wind is the highest of all time if that's based on ticket numbers?
No, that's based on adjusting. We know dollar grosses for a lot of movies. And Gone with the Wind worldwide grossed $400 million, which adjusted for inflation gets it up into the you know, an unbelievable amount of money. It's just way off the charts compared to the other movies. And, you know, tickets cost like a nickel then. But, it, you know, you can't get ticket sales going back more than a couple of decades, unfortunately. Pure dollar gross is a fair thing to look at. And another thing, people keep saying, oh, they charge more for Avatar. It's cheating. You know what? They have charged more for movies throughout history. You can go back to road shows in the 60s and the 50s and the 70s and the 40s. They would have special engagements. They'd give you a little program, and they would charge you top dollars, like, say, at the time, $5 rather than $2. So, I mean, this is not anything new. If you can get people to pay more to see your movie, then fair game. Fair enough.
Then guess what? It's going to make more money.
That's right, but that's like saying, well, I'll charge $1 million a ticket and I'll become a – if I get 100 people to go.
But then you're comparing apples to oranges. I don't see how that's fair at all.
If your movie is so special, people are willing to pay a premium
to see it. Avatar is not special.
Well, if people perceive your movie as being special and they're willing to pay top dollar to see it, whether it's, you know, West Side Story or My Fair Lady or Oklahoma or a million other movies throughout Hollywood's history – that have charged top dollar more than your regular movie, and they're all perfectly valid hits. If they're willing to pay more to see it, then that's then good for you. You know, that counts.
You can't.
And even if you just go to ticket sales, Avatar's a big hit. You can't gross. It's going to gross over $2 billion worldwide. It's a big hit by any standard. If it's only in the top 50 of all time, that's still a massive accomplishment.
Well, Avatar fell only 15% this weekend, which is phenomenal in a sixth week. That's unheard of. As I mentioned, it did have the best sixth week in domestic box office history, beating
That's
out
true.
Titanic. So James Cameron beat himself.
Heavens. If only he would do that regularly. I remember Titanic, the talk about legs. That movie made over $20 million a weekend for like 6 months in a row. It was unbelievable.
And it was also a terrible movie.
Oh, and it's compared to Avatar?
Oh, compared to Avatar, it's like Citizen Kane.
Exactly. And compared to Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen, which was the top grossing movie of the year, Avatar is, it's Titanic. I can't help it. I get all geeky about box office numbers. I wish we had ticket sales. Yeah, I wish we had ticket sales, but sadly we don't.
You know, because we're recording in a different way this week and I'm not in the studio, your voice, Michael, sounds very deep. I mean, it's not a good audio quality, but your voice is very manly.
It always sounds like this.
Well, you know, I wish, for the first time in years, I kind of wish I was at Sundance. I've always sort of avoided the festival because it seems so crowded and there's so many people. And invariably, just like one or two or three movies come out of it that actually get into theaters and are any good. And there's always some hype for some movie that comes out and it's actually awful. But, you know, this year it feels like the recession has sort of slapped it down again. And it's sort of out of control. Celebrityness and partiness seems to have calmed down. And there's quite a few movies that sound interesting. What's it been like, Sperling?
Well, you're right. I mean, last year Precious came out of Sundance. At the time it was called Push, which is based on the novel by Sapphire. And this year, I would say that if last year was Recession Sundance, where less people came, this year is Depression Sundance, because there is hardly anybody here in comparison to previous years. And up and down Main Street, there's Park City, Utah, is where the Sundance Film Festival is held. It's an old mining town that was turned into a ski resort town, so it's not really conducive to holding a film festival. And there is one main street that runs about a half a mile to a mile in Old Town, as it's called, and all of the vendors and merchants on that street usually rent out their storefronts to ambush marketers. It's not something that the festival likes, but it's something that they have learned to live with over the past decade. And so people like IBM and Yahoo and whoever it might be would come up to Park City during the festival and they'd have their little storefront and invite people in. This year, there's hardly any storefronts rented, and a lot of these merchants don't make enough money during the rest of the year to actually stay alive.
Well, gosh, what are they doing there if they can't stay alive except for the film festival? It's only been around there for a little while.
Well, 25, 26 years.
Yeah, I guess so.
In the grand scheme of things, that's a little while, Sperling.
Yeah, well.
No, you're right. It doesn't seem like it's been three decades. Well, but I mean, it's still crowded, right? It's just not as manic as it was the last five or so years. Or is it really, really empty?
No, it's just not as manic as it has been in past years.
My sister just came back from there, and she was hanging out with your boy, Michael Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She's got her kid, Devin Brochu, who she represents as an Hasher.
Oh, let's talk about Hesher for a second. First of all, Joseph Gordon-Levitt gives a phenomenal performance.
Of course.
And it's, I have it on my borderline list.
Mm-hmm. But he's good in it, yeah.
He's good in it.
Well, let's talk about the films that you liked first.
Well, this year, speaking of recession and depression, there are a lot of films up here about the economy and about capitalism. And one of the best films I saw is a documentary by Matt Whitecross and Michael Winterbottom. Winterbottom, of course, is known for directing narrative films. And it's a film based on Naomi Klein's book called Shock Doctrine. And it is a film about the rise of capitalism and how evil it has been throughout the last 50 years, starting with Pinochet in the 60s, all the way through Argentina, and Reagan and Thatcher in the 80s, and, of course, Bush in the 90s, sorry, Clinton and Bush in the 90s and the aughts. And it is a fascinating documentary based on a fascinating book. I really highly recommend it.
So capitalism is evil compared to what?
Well, compared to, really, it was comparing Keynesian, the Keynesian philosophy of capitalism versus the Milton Friedman and Chicago school of capitalism. And the Chicago school, their whole point was get rid of government entirely, privatize everything. The only thing that Milton Friedman wanted to have the government run were the roads, and I think one or two other things. But that was it, and that's pretty much what happened in Russia, and it's pretty much what happened in during the 80s. Everything was privatized, and it certainly is what happened in Iraq. It all leads up to Iraq being the most privately run war in history.
Well, I don't know about that. There have been whole wars, you know, fought by mercenary armies hired by people.
Sorry, but modern history, sorry.
Yeah, so it's really about different forms of capitalism and...
It's about two very specific types of capitalism, Keynesian and the Friedman version.
Chicago school. Well, what other capitalistic films were there?
Moving on.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, guess who sat next to me during that screening?
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
No. Wait, who did you say, Michael?
Michael Moore.
That is exactly right.
I follow your Twitters.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, halfway through the movie, everyone is riveted to this film and is finding it fascinating. And I wanted to turn to him and say, so what's it like watching a movie about capitalism that actually works?
This movie made a lot of money.
Yeah, I guess so. And I asked him afterwards, I said, so, you know, this was a very textbook way of approaching the subject and yours was more, you know, commercial, so to speak. Which do you think people will actually appreciate more or get more out of? And he said, well, I think in life, you know, you need both. You need Noam Chomsky and you need John Lennon.
Yeah. Noam Chomsky could not sing worth a damn.
But he was brilliant.
And is. What else? What about Company of Men? I heard about that movie.
Yeah, Company of Men is a film directed by John Wells, who is a writer primarily and a producer who has produced hit television shows such as ER and recently Southland. And he directed this film and got a few people to come by and star in it, like, well, there was Ben Affleck, and there was Tommy Lee Jones, and there was Craig T. Nelson, and there was Chris Cooper, and Maria Bello, and some of those folks were up here, actually. The film focuses on these three executives who work for a transportation company that built boats, and what happens to them as, well, Ben Affleck gets fired as an executive, and he's looking for work, and then eventually, other people wind up getting fired. And what happens as the company begins to downsize and what the aftermath of that is for all of these characters. It's a really interesting film, though it may not – I felt that not everybody may understand it because it's a little too blue blood in certain parts. And I have a clip of Ben Affleck talking about that very subject, about whether people would relate to it or not.
The whole point of movies is that you get introduced to worlds that aren't necessarily in your everyday life. Certainly people connect to emotionally feelings of fear and anxiety. Is my life going to change? Am I going to lose something that's important to me? And certainly today, now, because there's so much uncertainty and fear, and people, I think, connect to the idea, to whatever their social strata, of if that happens, if, you know, what if 10% of the country it has happened to, probably a little bit more, you know, with underemployment and the rest. And even beyond that, the fear that it might happen to them affects a lot of people. And I think when they, in connecting with that, they may be moved by the idea of what then would I do? what would that mean for me as a person? What would that mean for my soul? How would I reconfigure myself? You know, hopefully the movie works. If the movie fails, it won't be because people don't understand what it's like to be an executive. It'll be because we didn't do our job in executing the movie to connect with people as human beings.
Well, those all sound interesting, yet none of them are on your list that I saw of films that you've really liked. Very quickly, what are the ones that you really like a lot?
Well, I really liked Casino Jack, although it is mind-numbing. It's about Jack Abramoff, a very good documentary. Mm-hmm. I really also liked a film called Winter's Bone. Now, this is a film directed by Deborah Granick, and she directed Down to the Bone. And in my opinion, it's one of the best films up here. A lot of people are talking about it as a potential award winner. It's a film that stars a 17-year-old actress as the lead actor. Her name is Jennifer Lawrence, and she gives a superb performance. She plays a young girl in the Ozark Mountains whose father, who is a methamphetamine maker, or crystal meth maker, he has disappeared, and he was out on bail, and he put the family's home, which is this ramshackle kind of log cabin, up for his bond. So she will lose the house that she is raising her two brothers and sisters in, as well as her very sick mother, if she can't find her father. And she has to go through all of these clannish family tribes that are all related to her in some way, shape, or form. And it is riveting, suspenseful, fascinating, really. It's beautifully shot, a little slow, but it was intentionally slow. A well-made movie.
Now, do any of these movies that you're talking about have buyers yet?
Well, the only films that have buyers right now that I know of are films such as, Buried has a buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a film that stars Ryan Reynolds, and he plays a soldier in Iraq that wakes up. While he's in Iraq, he's captured, and he wakes up, and he's in a coffin buried. And he has to come up with $5 million. I haven't seen it, and it was bought by Lionsgate. And that was the first sale. Of course, Michael, as you know, coming out of Toronto, there were very few sales, and that was kind of the story, that indie film is dead. So everybody is looking at Sundance to see, is indie film still alive, or is it going to peter away? And the way they're tracking that is through acquisitions, the films that get picked up here for distribution.
Right.
Buried being the first. Actually, I take that back. The first one was Davis Guggenheim's film called Waiting for Superman, which is a documentary on the education system in the United States. Now, this is the filmmaker that made An Inconvenient Truth with Al Gore, and up here for the premiere was Bill Gates. I did not understand that at all.
Well, one of the...
Was he Twittering?
No, he was not, but he did talk about it, actually, on the press line.
Well, you know, one of my favorite TV shows right now is How I Met Your Mother, and that had big news that the creators of it got a big fat deal with Fox. And I know that Josh Radnor is there with Happy Thank You More Please. What do you think of that?
You know, it's a film that nobody can remember the name of because it's Happy Thank You More Please all squished together. There's, you know, one word leading
into the other. I remember it well. Every time I see it, it makes me smile.
Well, and it's a film that will probably do the same. It's a decent movie. I call it like a 500 Days of Summer light. Not as well written, not as well directed or put together, but it works. Josh Radnor stars in it as the lead character who is a struggling writer. He then winds up picking up a young child who must be 7 or 8 years old. He actually doesn't know how old he is. He picks him up on the subway. The boy is lost on the subway, and he winds up befriending this boy. And meanwhile, other characters are introduced, the writer's friends, and the writer's, I guess he doesn't have relatives, but mostly his friends. And so it's somewhat Woody Allen-esque in that it's shot in New York, and it has several different characters, and they're all about relationships. Zoe Kazan plays a role, and so does Malin Ackerman. And it's an interesting film. Somebody called it Aspirin, you know, that it's not really all that strong, but it's not that weak either. It gets the job done.
Aspirin, I've
never
heard of
that. But it's got to be good for him for a directing debut, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely one of the films people are talking about. Another film I liked, which no one will see, is called The Oath. And that's a film, although actually it will probably be on POV, at least in the United States, on public television. It is a film that tracks Abu Jandal and Salim Handal. And you probably remember Salim Handel's name or have heard it because he sued, I think it was Donald Rumsfeld. He is one of the prisoners, or was one of the prisoners, at Guantanamo Bay, as was Abu Jindal. Abu Jindal was Osama bin Laden's bodyguard, and Salim Handel was his driver.
Salim Hamdan, I think.
Hamdan, sorry, I'm reading, I'm going from memory here, I apologize. But it really tracks both of them, although we never see Hamdan because he's at Guantanamo Bay and refuses to be interviewed. But
I don't think they'd allow him to be interviewed in that way.
Well,
don't allow reporters in to interview people with cameras.
Well, he is out now. It's a fascinating story about the other side of jihad and who these people are and how they came to be and what their beliefs are. It's made by Lori Portress, and she is a woman, and she shot in Yemen for months on end. I mean, it's fascinating.
It's hard to get good camera angles when you're wearing a chador, I suppose.
Yes.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is one of my favorite actors, and he's been directing a lot of plays off Broadway, especially the plays of Bob Glaudini, and now they've turned one of them into a movie, Jack Goes Boating. I think you liked that one too, didn't you?
Yes, it's a very quiet, understated film, and it's Philip Seymour Hoffman plays a cab driver, a limo driver, who is very shy and meek and very overweight, as he is in real life, actually. And he is introduced to a girl played by Amy Ryan, and it's about how they kind of overcome their own shyness to come together, while at the same time, the friends that introduce them, Daphne, played by Daphne Ruben Vega, and the gentleman's name I completely forget.
John Ortiz,
yes. I knew it was John. I couldn't remember the last name. But their marriage is falling apart, and it's very slow, very understated, very funny, and all in all, it's a good film worth seeing. I don't know how many people will actually see the film. It's a lot like The Visitor from a couple of years ago, which played both Toronto and Sundance. And
Hated it.
But, you know, no, very few people saw that film, and it was a good film, even though Michael hated it.
Well, what about normal movies for normal people?
Avatar was not here at all.
Thank God, I'm so surprised.
I think people will see Company Men, and I think they'll probably see Happy Thank You More Please.
What about Hesher?
Hesher, it just doesn't go anywhere. You know, it's a great film that for Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he turns in a fantastic performance. And halfway through the movie, you see where it's going. Rainn Wilson plays a father, and the son is played by
Devin Brochu,
your sister's client. And their mother has just died in a car accident. The father is, you know, pretty much mentally out of it. The son is quickly becoming a delinquent, and the son is about 12 years old, 13 maybe. And
13.
And he somehow winds up meeting Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who is this heavy metal, delinquent, smoking guy, runs around with his shirt off half the movie. And
that sounds really good.
It's an interesting film up to about 70% of the movie, and then it just completely falls apart. It doesn't go anywhere.
Well, there are some films you should try and see if you haven't yet. Have you seen the Pat Tillman documentary? I want to know about that. I want to know about Catfish, and I want to know about The Runaways, the film about the early days of Joan Jett when she was in a punk band.
Well, The Runaways has gotten a lot of attention up here at Sundance, but it is about you know, Joan Jett's first band. The problem is that it only screens three times. I think it has one more screening. The attention it's getting is really because Kristen Stewart from Twilight is in it. But other than that, it's not getting a lot of attention. You know, nobody's saying, oh, it's...
I mean, people aren't actually liking the movie. They're just excited because she's in it.
I don't think anybody's seen the movie, frankly. In fact, the publicist held a special screening just for the press. And I didn't make it to that screening. I was seeing Get Low with Bill Murray and Sissy Spacek and Robert Duvall and Lucas Black, which is a kind of a... It's an okay film. It's a very Sundance movie about... Well, I'm not even going to go. It's an okay.
And overall, what's your impression of the quality of the films? Overall, this Sundance looks like it's a really good one, or a good one, or a typical one, or what's the deal?
I think that it's pretty solid. I haven't like really walked out of a film going, "Ugh, that was ridiculous. Why was that here? I just wasted all my time." They're pretty decent, actually. John Cooper is now the director of the festival, and Trevor Groth is now the festival programmer. They take over from Jeffrey Gilmore. And they have worked at the festival for a number of years, John Cooper dating all the way back to the 90s. And So this is the first year where their films make up the entire festival slate.
Where did Jeff Gilmore end up going to?
He wound up going to the Tribeca Film Festival. He is here. I saw him walking around. But you asked about the Pat Tillman story. I haven't seen it. I hope to see it. You know, the thing about Sundance is there's always a conflict. You know, you're either doing an interview and can't see a film, or you're seeing a film and can't do an interview, or you're seeing a film and so you can't see another film. I haven't seen the Pat Tillman story. I hear it's very good. Restrepo is supposed to be fantastic, and this is the film that Sebastian Younger co-directed, and he is the writer of A Perfect Storm, and it's about he, along with another filmmaker, spent a year in Afghanistan with the 2nd Platoon, kind of embedded with them, and it's supposed to be phenomenal, and I really hope to get to see it. Catfish, you asked about, Michael. Now, I'm not going to tell you anything about it because, A, I haven't seen it, and B, everybody that has seen it who raves about it, this film by far, Catfish I'm speaking about, is the big buzz film of the festival. Everybody seems to like it, love it. Nobody will talk about it. So I get this sense that...
Why not?
Because
it's got something about it that you don't want to know until you see it.
That's right.
Oh, it's like a twist or something?
Yeah, it's like a Crying Game type of twist. Not that it's the same twist as Crying Game, but like where you want to go into it not knowing something. And nobody
right,
will
like
talk about
it. Sense.
So I have purposefully avoided all information and talk about that film. So I don't know anything about it other than its name.
I'm going to hop online immediately and check that out.
Spoiler alert. Well, the Hollywood Reporter reviewed The Runaways, and it said it bursts with energy, youth, excess, female empowerment, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Thanks to the stars, I'm paraphrasing, it's an instant hit worldwide, but is it any good? Quote, surprisingly, yes.
Oh, so yeah. Now I would see that movie.
Yeah. Now, maybe you could see some of these movies on YouTube. What is the deal with this YouTube deal with Sundance, Sperlin?
Well, YouTube is actually teaming up with Sundance to put, I think, five films here from the festival. Most of them are from the next selection of the festival. And the next section of the festival is filled with films that cost under, I think, $200,000. So you can rent films now. And they are asking directors and filmmakers to upload their movies to YouTube, and then they can rent them out to a global audience.
It's streaming, right? They're not like sending out discs.
No, they're not sending out discs. It is streaming. And effectively, they're launching a campaign called Filmmakers Wanted right here at the festival. Now, I haven't seen much about it other than one postcard. And the postcard read, this is what they say, you know, Filmmakers Wanted is on the front, and then you flip it around. And it says, 1, make a film. 2, celebrate. 3, upload your film to YouTube rentals. 4, set your price and your rental duration. 5, keep all your rights, and this is where they kind of missed kind of asterisk, but I'll get to that in a second. 6, connect with a global audience. 7, make money. 8, repeat. And that's the entire campaign that I've seen. Now, the thing that they're not saying is that, you keep the rights as the filmmaker, but one of the things that a lot of distributors look for and the people who acquire films is, has this film been seen anywhere on video, television, in theaters? Has it been released theatrically?
You just lost your online rights.
That's right.
No, you retain them because you put it up yourself.
You retain them, but then a lot of
distributors... Yeah, but they'll be less likely to take it, perhaps.
That's right. Oh. That is correct.
But obviously, this is for films that have no chance of getting a distributor. Once you fail to get a distributor, you can always post it online, and you could do that anyway. So is it the idea that the branding of YouTube and Sundance will allow you to reach a wider audience, or do they curate it or limit it to a certain... I mean...
No, that's the thing. Confused. I mean, yes, you can reach a global audience.
Well, one thing is clear. If you distribute your movie online and that's the only way it gets seen, you're not going to be eligible for any SAG Awards, which were just handed out again right after the Golden Globes.
Aren't the SAG Awards kind of like the Golden Globes 2? At least this year, it seemed that way. I did not get a chance to see them.
Yes, they were. They're a lot like the Golden Globes, which leads me to believe that the Oscars are not going to be a big surprise to us. What to me is most interesting about the SAG Awards is that because the actors are the biggest voting block of the Academy, mm-hmm. you can usually depend on whoever wins the SAG Award or whoever is nominated for it is going to be nominated for an Academy Award.
So it's a really good precursor, especially for the acting categories.
Yeah.
Well, and of course,
well, only for the acting categories because SAG is only gives it to actors, which I've always found that best casts.
That's their movie equivalent.
Yeah, which is very strange.
And this year, but no, they're basically saying this is the best film. And this year, a big acting showcase was Inglourious Basterds, and that won the SAG Award, right?
Yeah, that was a nice little moment for them.
Well, it won the Ensemble Award, I believe.
Right, right, right. That's their equivalent of best film.
So we have
the Golden Globes going to Avatar, and we have SAG going to Inglourious Basterds, and we have Producers Guild going to The Hurt Locker. So I don't know. I think it's the Best Picture is the big one, and I think that's still a big question mark.
Yeah, well, we know what three of them are going to be.
Won awards? I know Monique won for Best Supporting Actress in a film. I know Tina Fey won for Best Supporting Actress in a television comedy, and Alec Baldwin won for a fourth time.
Lead. She won lead.
Oh, sorry. Yes. My fault.
And it was Jeff Bridges and Sandra Bullock and you know, it was
Monique
the usual suspects.
And Christoph Waltz. Yeah.
So, yeah, all the usual suspects. Christoph Waltz for Inglourious Basterds, of course.
Did he
was
give
Sandra
another good
Bullock
speech?
Drunk? Did anybody watch it besides me?
No, I didn't. I didn't watch it.
I was up here at Sundance.
It was very strange. She's going through this whole thing about thanking her husband, Jesse James, every time she gets up on stage. And it was real sweet at the Golden Globes, which she got kind of, you know, teary. It was like, you know, I've never known what it was like for someone to have my back. But this time she started off saying something that was kind of fun, saying, you know, thanks to my husband who works really hard and then puts on a monkey suit and comes here and hangs out with people he doesn't know. But then she went on to say, and I think you're really hot and I really want you right now. And I was like, oh, my God, somebody get her off stage.
Well, somebody that needs to be taken off stage is Felicity Huffman. I don't think she'll ever be asked to present at an award show again. I heard she flubbed up her presentation again a week after flubbing up her presentation at the Golden Globes.
I didn't see her any presentation at the SAGs. My guess would be that she was so nervous because she'd screwed up so badly at the Golden Globes, which she didn't even need to have been at the Golden Globes. It was like Ricky Gervais talking about introducing her and then her introducing the Golden Globes people. It didn't make any
sense. Yeah.
No, my guess is that she was just extra nervous.
And I heard Drew Barrymore gave another hysterical speech as if somehow...
Oh, she went up there and she literally just stood there and kept going, it was very uncomfortable. And she had no lipstick on. All I could think of was that she looked like a dead person.
Wow, I don't think they'll ever give her another award.
It's true, though. The way you accept your award can affect your chances with other ones. You give a nice, gracious, or heartwarming speech, people want to hear it again on the Oscars. You give something indifferent or obnoxious like Mickey Rourke, it screws your chances.
It does. You know who was really funny and gave a wonderful speech was Betty White, who got...
She's great.
Yeah, she's really funny. She... Whatever their big award is, you know.
SAG, yeah, it was their...
You've had a great life award that was introduced by Sandra Bullock, and who gave a wonderful speech about how she hated Betty White, was totally annoyed by Betty White because she was, you know, such a hard worker and was so successful. And then Betty White gets up and she says, isn't it nice to see how far a girl, as plain as she is, can go? She meaning Sandra Bullock. It was very funny. It was a good moment.
Well, and then she left her award on stage when Sandra Bullock was taking her off.
Oh, she definitely was not completely there.
Well, she's 88 years old, so...
Yeah, and she showed it. She looked it.
Well, I can tell you two people who are not going to get SAG Awards next year or the year after for Pirates of the Caribbean 4, Orlando Bloom or Keira Knightley.
Good for them. I know they're not going to be in the fourth one.
I don't think it's their choice.
I think that shows an enormous amount of restraint. These movies are awful. I don't care how well they do. But there's no reason for Keira Knightley or Orlando Bloom to be in them.
It doesn't help them. They don't get any credit for the movie's box office, obviously.
I don't know if it's their choice either.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Did they really walk away or were they just said, we're not interested with you anymore?
They were quoted as saying that they'd walked away. That doesn't mean that that's what happened.
Right. And I've heard quotes that said, no, the story was going in a different direction and Keira Knightley and Orlando Bloom were not going to be in it. But Johnny Depp is returning as Captain Jack Sparrow.
And there's another $1 billion in the hopper for the studio, which is why it was so ridiculous for the other studio to walk away from Tobey Maguire and Sam Raimi. I don't get it. You know, I don't care how bad the movies are. I don't care if you're not happy. Let them make the movie they want. Take the $1 billion. And if you need to relaunch the franchise or the new pirate in 10 years, you can do it. You can have Jack Sparrow's son in 10 years. You don't need to relaunch it now. Keep making them while they're still making you $1 billion a movie. So again, I say the Spider-Man thing is ridiculous. That's just me.
Yeah, and again, I say no one cares about Tobey Maguire.
Of course, it's a billion-dollar franchise. Every single one of those movies grosses $1 billion.
Spider-Man is a billion-dollar franchise. Tobey Maguire is just a pain in the ass.
Okay, well, we talked about that last week, and last week we ran so long that...
I need a cigarette.
Well, you know, Orlando Bloom was in a film up here at Sundance called...
Oh, I gave you the segue.
You gave me a segue? For what?
I need a cigarette.
I need a cigarette. Where's my damn cigarette?
Okay, so you must be talking about this article in the New York Times that this article, not yet rated, written by A.O. Scott, about the MPAA rating system. And yeah, that's the rating system here in the United States.
I loved this article. Because in Avatar, that movie again, Sigourney Weaver's character has a line where she says, "Where's my damn cigarette?" And now Smoke-Free Movies, which I guess is some kind of a watchdog group, is all up in arms because this movie should have been rated like R or something because it's got smoking in it. And the whole article talks about where can the MPAA step in, where should they step out, who is in charge, who should be in charge.
Like, why did Billy Elliot get an R rating? It's a film about, you know, a young boy who wants to be a ballet dancer, but his father wants him to be a soccer player. And now it's a hit Broadway musical, so why is it rated R?
And well, didn't get an R rating because it was a boy who wanted to be a ballerina.
No, because of the language being
used. He got an R rating because people talk like people talk, and there was a lot of, you know, bad language in it.
You know, they mentioned in this article Kirby Dick's 2006 film called This Film Is Not Yet Rated. Now, this was a film that I saw up here at Sundance, and I happened to be sitting next to somebody who I won't name, but they used to be my neighbor, and they were a film buyer for a cinema chain in the United States. And part of what Kirby Dick's film did was explain the ratings process and go over how a filmmaker can petition a given rating, usually a rating that is an R rating, down to a PG-13 or a PG film. And the group that they petition is a super secret. Nobody knew. And in this film, they started listing the names of all of the people on the petition committee. And the gentleman sitting next to me, this film buyer, was one of them. And I just kind of, when his name flashed on screen, I just kind of poked him and went, you may want to leave now.
I find the MPA really rather a curious group because when I worked in creative advertising at Paramount, that was, for some reason, one of the things that my department did. And it's absolutely true that directors will put in more nude shots and more utterances of curses because they know that, you know, they're going to have to take something out. So they put in more than they need so that the MPAA can have stuff taken out and they can feel like they did their job and everybody wins. It's a load of BS. It really is. And my personal feeling is that the MPAA should not be rating our films and shoving their own morality at us. Smoking cigarettes is legal. You shouldn't have to have a movie rated R because somebody smokes a cigarette. It's ridiculous.
Well, that's an outside group that wants the MPAA to take that and make that their rule. And I agree with you. It's ridiculous because it's legal. You know, if they want no smoking to be shown in movies, they should just, you know, urge filmmakers to avoid it when it's not necessary. But, you know, but it's true. There's a long history of the MPAA, you know, not caring about violence. But if you have sex or something like marijuana, you suddenly get freaked out. Yeah. But, you know, as the MPAA deciding to censor itself before Congress passed laws, you know, before the MPAA, you had little rating boards in every town in the country, and it was a nightmare. And towns in the South would not let you show, you know, a black man in the same room with a white woman. You know, I'm exaggerating, but it's basically true.
So no,
the
MPAA,
it did a lot of good in clearing up all those local fiefdoms and getting rid of them and creating one standard that the industry created itself, but they're not transparent. They're not up with the times. They're a little backwards, and they need to sort of grow with the times and get a little more, you know, intelligent. Billy Elliot getting R was ridiculous. And, you know, this hatred of sex and the body as opposed to violence, decapitation, is also ridiculous.
Yeah, like if you show, you can show a butt crack, but only for like 1 second. If you show it for longer than 1 second, then that, you know, makes a huge difference. And you can say the F word, but not if you mean the actual act. I mean, it's hysterical. Right.
Am I going to have to edit out butt crack, do you think?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, just check.
As long as we say it very quickly and briefly, butt crack. Yeah, so, you know, in a few weeks, I should say, Clash of the Titans, the new Warner Brothers movie, will come out in theaters. And we don't know yet what rating it will get. It hasn't been reviewed yet. I don't think it has an MPAA rating. But what drove me crazy was this article in Variety saying that Warner Brothers is deciding right now, they may have made the decision, but as of the article a few days ago, they're deciding whether to release it in 3D or not. Meaning this film was just filmed. It's a big spectacle-heavy film. And they're just saying, maybe we should rejigger this and pretend it's a 3D movie and charge people, you know, extra money just to see the movie in 3D. Even though it wasn't filmed as a 3D movie, it wasn't designed as a 3D movie, they have the ability and they're just going to slap a 3D rating on it and pretend it's a 3D film.
Well, that's my question. If it wasn't shot in 3D, how can they make it a 3D movie?
A lot of films are not shot in 3D. In fact, a lot of Avatar was not shot in 3D. It's shot in 2D and then what's called dimensionalized later.
But every moment of Avatar was designed to be seen in 3D. That was his whole point. He refused to release the film. He waited decades because he wanted the technology to catch up so he could make it 3D.
Now, there is the difference. What you're talking about is absolutely true. There's a company in California called In3 that takes the stuff that's shot 2D and dimensionalizes it. They did the Star Wars demos, so they released
they didn't release them because they weren't that good.
Well, they only did a couple of minutes. They didn't do the whole film.
Well, how is this different from colorizing?
Well, it's not in that regard, but I will say, Michael, what is interesting is some films are shot 2D with the intention, like you said, like Jim Cameron, of becoming 3D.
Sure.
G-Force was such a film. They shot it with somebody from In3 on the set, working with the director to make sure
That's fine.
If you're going to go backwards and say all of a sudden trying to stick your metal rod up into the clouds, trying to get that bolt of lightning to strike it like an Avatar bolt of lightning, well, guess what? It doesn't always work out that well.
Well, this is incredibly damaging to both their attempt to sell 3D, and they just want to jack the price. This is what 3D is. They're just going to – any movie will be shot in 3D, whether it needs to be or not, and they're just going to charge you more because they want to raise ticket prices, and they're using 3D as an excuse, and it couldn't be clearer than in this case. Clash of the Titans is not a 3D movie, and I will purposely go see it in 2D because what's the point?
Yes, I would agree with you on that one. Unless you planned up front to make your movie 3D, it's not going to come out all that great.
Yeah, no, there are films that could be repurposed that would make sense creatively, especially when you have the digital files like you do with the animated films shot in CGI. But just a typical film that you've shot and you just suddenly say, oh, I could make more money if I pretend it's a 3D film. This to me everybody should be angry about this.
Well, you know, last week's big news, and sorry for the jerky segue here, but last week's big news was the Conan O'Brien, Jay Leno, NBC debacle, as it's now being referred to.
And now Conan says he's going to start broadcasting in 3D?
No. No, not at all. Although that would be...
Oh, there was no segue at all. Oh, okay.
No, there was no segue whatsoever.
I like that, though.
But what I found interesting is that it's taken us this long to even talk about it.
Talk about it.
Because it is...
His final one?
I did not because I was, again, at Sundance. But, you know, it was the big news story of last week along with Sundance. And it took us, however long, we are in this show, to talk about it. So have people already begun to forget?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's over. The story is over because the story is over.
Yeah, now he's in reruns. Almost everyone's in reruns. And when Conan launches his show, there'll be attention again on Fox or ABC or online or whatever it may be. But,
Leno comes back, the story.
When Leno comes back in September, March. That'll be news. But
Leno's coming back in March after the Olympics.
After the Olympics, you're right. I'm sorry. So that'll be a big hit. People will be paying attention to what stars will come on. Are they going to boycott Leno because they don't want to piss off Conan? Or will they just go on Leno because he's got the platform and there you go. He's going to have better lead-ins.
It's interesting. They were asking people at the SAG Awards whether they were Team Leno or Team Conan. Which, by the way, how come we don't call them Leno and O'Brien? We call them and Conan. It's always Leno and Conan. People either didn't answer or they said they were on Team Conan. And anybody who was on an NBC show was like, I can't answer that. But I just thought it was interesting that, Conan seems to have the support of the artistic community.
I liked what he said on his last show. He said, as I set off for exciting career opportunities, I just want to make one thing clear to everyone listening out there. I will do nudity.
Last show was beautiful. It was really, it was very sweet. I liked what he said about not being a cynic. It was very real. It was very genuine.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, why don't we play a clip of what he said?
A lot of people have been asking me about my state of mind. And I'll be honest with you, walking away from The Tonight Show is the hardest thing I have ever had to do. making this choice has been enormously difficult. This is the best job in the world. I absolutely love doing it. And I have the best staff and crew in the history of the medium. I will fight anybody who says I don't, but no one would. but despite this sense of loss, I really feel this should be a happy moment. Every comedian dreams of hosting The Tonight Show. And for 7 months, I got to do it. And I did it my way, with people I love. I do not regret 1 second of anything that we've done here.
Well, that is nice. I mean, I watched it last week, and it was certainly the best shows he's done so far. He was sort of freed up because he didn't have to. He's a terrible interviewer. I mean, even when you can see him glued to his little postcard with his questions, no matter who the guest is. But this week, because it was all about him and them joking with him, he was a lot freer than he's been. Andy Richter was no longer isolated over in a corner. He slowly had moved over to the couch, and he was part of the show just like he was back in the old days. And they were definitely some of his best shows. But I have to say, I was surprised by the ratings. I mean, Conan could not have asked for more media attention, more excitement, more drama surrounding his show in the last week, and the ratings were up. But for most of the week, from what I can gather, the ratings were up about 30% over his regular audience of 2.1 million people, which means he was getting about 2.8 million people, which is still way less than Jay was getting, less than Letterman was getting. The only night where he beat Letterman, as far as I can tell, was the final night.
But it doesn't help when your lead-in sucks.
No, I know, but you had every bit of attention in the world. People didn't need a lead-in to know that Conan was having his final week. It was massive news all over the world. The fact is that when he walked away, he got a rating of about a 7.1. A 7.0 in his finale, which is just about the same he got as his debut. When Jay said goodbye, he got an 8.8, which is not that much higher. Johnny Carson got a 31.9. So neither of these guys.
In Johnny Carson's days, there was like no such thing as the internet. I mean,
no, I know, really, but Johnny Carson wasn't that long. Well, it was 17 years ago. But yeah, I'm just saying, Johnny Carson is a whole different sort of level of guy. And, you know, Jay and Conan, neither of them measure up to Carson.
Well, to your point, Michael, there is an article in the LA Times written by Joe Flint about how the ad rates for late-night television have gone down. A couple years ago, they were $50,000 for a 30-second spot. They're now $35,000.
But ratings are down.
The ratings are down, and now, as Joe Flint points out, there are a plethora of choices. You've got Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. You've got
channels.
Yeah, 1,000 channels. You got Jimmy Kimmel. You got David Letterman. And of course,
but more importantly, you've got the internet.
And so you can catch those little snippets instead of watching the whole show. You can catch just little snippets on Hulu or on YouTube.
Well, I was fascinated to see, you know, that's absolutely true, but they still matter. And I was fascinated to see that Jay Leno may be going on Oprah, you know, Damage Control anybody. I saw that on Extra or something. God help me.
Did you see Jay Leno's, I guess, side of the story? He gave a kind of a 5-minute talk about what his side of the story was.
Well, I read that, but I didn't see where his side of the story was.
It was very straightforward. He said, you know, I was number one. They came to me and said, you know, we don't think you're going to stay number one. We want to replace you with Conan in 5 years. He said, no, I don't want to do that. But, you know, he agreed, trying to, you know, be nice to everyone. And then when it was time for he wanted to get out of his contract, so that he could go and start another show somewhere else. And they wouldn't allow it. And they said, not only aren't we going to allow it, we're going to give you a show at 10 o'clock. And he said, well, I don't think that's going to work. And they said, no, trust me. We have all these figures and research that shows that, you know, I think his
joke. Yeah, they got out these spreadsheets and charts and stuff.
Jay Leno's chin at 10 works, you know. And so he said, oh, all right, I'll give it a shot. And then when they came to him and said, do you want to do 11:30? He said, well, I'm not, you know, so hot about doing a half an hour, but sure, I'll do it. What does Conan think of this? And he said, the NBC executives assured me they were absolutely almost certain that he was going to go along with it.
Yeah. Well, no, I do feel very empathetic for Jay Leno. He's never had any critical acclaim. And let's face it, he and Letterman and Conan, anybody who does a late night talk show, is wildly competitive and egotistical and insane. You know, they're all incredibly driven people, you know, to do these shows night after night. And, you know, he got grief when he got the Tonight Show. He got grief when he left the Tonight Show. He got grief when he went to 10. He got grief when he went back. And all he kind of ever did from his point of view was just say, you know, say yes or no to what they offered him. You know, he was Carson's major substitute for many, many years. He did more you know, guest hosting of the Tonight Show than anyone in history. And of course he wanted the show. Dave wanted it too. Dave was Carson's anointed successor. But when NBC said, do you want it? He said, of course I want it. And he took it. And he was number one for 17 years. And they said, we want you to step down. He's like, all right. Then he said, here, do it at 10. He said, all right. He said, all right, now you're going to go back to 11:30. He says, great. I never wanted to leave anyway. I was number one. You know,
yeah,
but
he said,
somehow
okay,
is the bad
I'm going to be snake in the grass and take someone's job.
How is he snake in the grass? Conan took his job.
He was kicked off of the Tonight Show. Done.
For no good
over.
Reason. That was NBC's fault. He never wanted to leave. He was number one. He was doing great.
You can't
look
do
at
that.
It from his
he
point of view. Look
if
at
he
him.
He's been
for,
a classy guy. He
no.
Said, you know what? This is Conan's show now. I'm going to leave and go to Fox.
Why was not Conan a classy guy and say, I don't want the show. Jay clearly doesn't want to leave. He's number one in the ratings. Why am I taking over a show?
That's in his contract.
Yeah, I mean, when you're on a show or a thing, if it doesn't work in the ratings,
your show. On the Tonight Show, and Jay Leno is a complete snake who was probably planned this all along. And they said, hey, you want your old show back? And he said, totally. I mean,
Jay's plan
would
have been to keep
the
Tonight Show. Jay's
guy is not liked in the comedy community. He's not liked behind the scenes. A total jerk.
I've never heard anybody say Jay Leno's a jerk in private.
I've never heard anybody like him. Sue me for slander. I think what he did is so disgusting and frankly sort of scary.
What? Because he took back the show that he never wanted to walk away from.
He too bad, buddy. Too bad.
Well, it's too bad for Conan. You failed.
He didn't fail.
NBC didn't give you... Of course he failed. He did fail. Even on his final show,
Jay Leno failed.
Jay Leno did not fail.
And how can you possibly say his 10 o'clock show did not fail?
I'm saying as the Tonight Show host, Jay Leno did not fail. When you're a show on TV and you replace a show and your ratings fall by 50% for any reason, chances are you will be fired, period.
But that's not how it started. It didn't start with Conan getting bad ratings. If everything started, the domino began with Leno getting bad ratings.
No, the domino began with Leno being removed from Tonight Show when he was number one and NBC whooped out and worried about the number two guy and the cool guy rather than keeping the ratings. That was the mistake. If Jay had his druthers, his plan would not have been to leave the Tonight Show so he could seize it again 8 months later. He would have stayed there the entire time for the next 20 years. He would have no desire.
Should never have gone back to take the Tonight Show again. Just should never have done it.
Well, NBC, just breaking in here.
oh, yeah, we're doing a show.
I was just going to mention that NBC's profit is down 30%. And they're going to lose $250 million loss on the Winter Olympics. They have to pay Conan O'Brien $33 million to get out of his contract. They're paying $12 million to the staff of the Conan O'Brien show or the Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien. And so, yeah, there are a lot of reasons, including the fact that Universal Pictures had a very weak slate and very weak returns in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, well, NBC's in a mess. But they'll come back again because every network has its downs and ups.
The biggest loser by far is NBC.
Yeah.
Indeed. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our popular segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and decide whether they are a big deal or a big whoop. Our first story this week is one that I unfortunately participated in, which is the rumors that Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie had come to a separation agreement to split their assets.
What, did you tweet this or something?
Yes, I did, and I apologize.
Oh!
So, I mean, it seemed real. It seemed like, you know, there were a couple of news stories out there, and apparently it is not true.
Well, you know what? Having said that, I think where there's smoke, there's fire. I would not be surprised.
So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
It's a big whoop.
It is a very big deal because Angelina Jolie may be on the market again.
And you've got a chance with her.
Well, see, now you guys are playing into this. There were rumors about Jennifer Lopez and her husband, Mark Antony, saying, oh, they were getting a divorce. And they're not divorced. They're happily married. I don't think it's true that there's smoke where there's fire, not in this stuff. And it's a big deal because everybody who repeated something from the news of the world should have known better, that the source of the rumor was not backed up. It was malarkey. It was, you know, it talked about them going to a divorce lawyer when they're not even married. You know, you can tell the UK press is crazy. When you look and see who your original source is, you should say, wait a second, how did they break this story? And you should know that they are not a good source for running something like this. And to repeat it as if it was news is shameful for everybody who did it. So it's a big deal for everybody who repeated this just because they thought it was exciting. Sorry, Sperling.
Well, another group going through a divorce is Aerosmith. Apparently, Joe Perry, the guitarist, I believe, is saying that they are auditioning new lead singers. Steven Tyler is presently in rehab. He was addicted to painkillers, and they want to be back out on tour, so they're going to go out and audition lead singers. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big deal. This is Aerosmith.
Michael?
Big whoop. Aerosmith has, they're just a touring act at this stage of the day.
Our next story is about DVRs and what people do with them. Apparently, they do not watch television commercials. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I love this. It totally goes against what we talked about like a month ago.
It supports us.
It supports common sense. People who DVR shows are not watching the commercials.
Yes, previously they had argued that almost half or at least 40% of people who recorded shows on their DVR would then watch the commercials. And I guess this new study is saying, no, that is not true. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Yeah, people are not watching commercials. That's completely true.
Big deal? Big whoop.
That's a big deal.
Michael?
It's a big deal. It's the rise of common sense. When something doesn't make sense, study
it
again.
Look
at the people who are pushing it. And I believe it was the DVR industry who said, oh, don't worry about it. They're watching the ads.
It was a bigger story when it was the flip-flop the other way, when it was like people are watching them and all of us were like, wait, what? How can that be?
Our next story is about 8 to 18-year-olds. Apparently, they are consuming more media than ever, 7 hours and 38 minutes per day. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
Big whoop. Didn't we already know this?
Michael?
It's a big whoop if they can increase it. I think if they could not sleep, maybe they'd be up to 10 or 15 hours a day.
The second week of American Idol had massive ratings, 33% and 22% over last season. Is this a big deal, Michael?
It's a huge deal. It's unbelievable. No TV show has ever been number one for 6 seasons, much less 6 seasons in a row. That's exactly what's going to happen to Idol. And it's growing in the ratings while it's doing it. It's unbelievable. It's just an absolute, there's never been a show like Idol.
But can they hold it up when Simon Cowell is gone? I have no opinion. Ask me when Simon Cowell is not part of the show anymore.
Quincy Jones is putting a reunion together. And it's not a family reunion. It's a reunion, I guess, the 25th anniversary of the recording of We Are the World, which was written by Michael Jackson. In part, yes. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
A big whoop. I can't even express how much I don't care.
Michael?
It's a big whoop because they're so slow. This is a digital world. We've already had the on-air charity benefit, and Quincy Jones still hasn't organized the recording. You know, it should have been out on iTunes 2 weeks ago.
You know, I ran into Roger Friedman up here in Park City, and he is leaving to go and cover both the Grammys, of course, and this reunion. You might remember Roger Friedman works for The Hollywood Reporter now, Showbiz 411, and he helped us cover the Michael Jackson death back in June of last year. Our next story is about, unfortunately, Karen, Roman Polanski, who had requested from a judge that he be sentenced in absentia. We are still trying to find absentia on the map.
And the judge said, no deal.
Apparently the judge couldn't find absentia either and said, no, you can come to the United States and be sentenced. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Even the woman that he raped, who he settled in the civil suit with, has said, please allow him to be judged in absentia. His lawyers are already appealing it. So it's a crazy situation.
Of course, this upholds what the judge decided a couple of years ago. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I really don't care. I'm really bored of talking about Roman Polanski, kind of like I'm bored of talking about Avatar. You guys know how I feel. The guy's a complete scumbag. He should be in jail.
Wow.
I don't care where they sentence him or where they do it all. I don't care if it's in absentia or here. Just.
But he went to jail. He served time in jail already. Not enough by today's standards, but at the standards of the time, he did.
I agree with you.
He's a scumbag, and the movie makes me believe that more. Roman Polanski wanted
the standards of the time. I'm not sure that's true.
That is absolutely true. That it's very hard to prosecute a rape case. They made a deal. He served time. He was in jail, and they'd already all the agreement was made. It was not an extraordinary lenient sentence compared to other similar cases where
he
a deal was made.
He hadn't been sentenced yet. How could he have served time?
He served time as part of the deal. He served time. He went into jail. He was in minimum security prison. He served time for rehab and it was an actual prison. And that was going to count as time served towards the sentence that he was going to receive. And it was going to be a blanket deal and he would be allowed out.
Right. Time served towards the sentence he was going to receive. I want
That's
him
right.
to receive that sentence.
Right. And this is all documented quite well in Marina Zenovich's film, Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired.
Yeah, and it makes me like Polanski a lot less when you see the film, so I agree with Karen about that.
Oh, such a scumbag. Oh, God.
Well, that brings us to our last segment, Inside Baseball, where we discuss the stories only people in Hollywood might care about, or know about, really. Karen, this week you highlighted a story for us to talk about. Why don't you fill us in?
It's called Transmedia Storytelling, and this is actually, I think, the future of entertainment. And this company called Blacklight Transmedia just signed a first look deal with Imagine Entertainment, which is Brian Grazer and Ron Howard. And what transmedia storytelling is that it's not like selling a script for a movie or selling a TV show. It's selling what they call an intellectual property. And it's a story that can be told on different forms of media at the same time. So you've got, you know, a movie that will address part of the story, and then you've got a video game that addresses part of it, and a TV show, and all different kinds of media that are all telling the same, all from the same world, telling different aspects of that world.
It's different than, say, a summer blockbuster where you spin stuff off because it's designed as a world where all these great, interesting, fascinating things are going to happen in a lot of different platforms.
Well, I think that's interesting because we were kind of mocking this idea, like last week or the week before, that ABC wants to take Lost and create comic books and what have you with it. And we were mocking that idea, but in a way that is transmedia storytelling. But real transmedia storytelling, from the way I see it, is that that's the plan in the first place. It's not taking a movie or a television show that was successful and saying, how else can we make money off it?
I just think this is so ass backwards.
Well, no, I mean, I think that this could do really well for like detective stories. You can see if the film, you can see it on, you can see pieces of it on television, in books, in magazines, in online, and you can start piecing together a detective story.
Yeah, but that's not my point. I can see it working in, there could be an example of something that would work where you set out to do this. But basically, it's incredibly hard to create a great film or a great video or a great TV show or a great graphic novel. And to set out and say, we're going to create something that's going to work on 27 platforms. People do this. They've been doing this for decades. They don't want just a summer blockbuster. They want a summer blockbuster with a spinoff animated series and a board game. And, you know, it used to be a board game, and now it's a video game. And they just come up with all these crazy extrapolating ideas from, you know, just one property. It's like, you have to create the one property. And if it's really good, it can work in other areas. And yes, sometimes you're going to launch it in multiple areas, but just to say, we're going to create stuff that's going to be so unbelievably fascinating, it's going to work on 27 levels, is just
But that's
backwards.
Not what they're saying. That's not what they're saying.
That's exactly what they're saying. They're saying we're going to create properties that are going to be inherently successful and are going to be so tantalizing that we're going to want to launch them in all these different areas, and they're all going to feed off each other and be creatively and intellectually and commercially exciting. When I'm saying, you know what? Just try and make a good movie. And if you make a good movie, then you can be prepared and ready
but
to launch.
But what you're saying then is that you're giving movies the greater weight in all of
or
this.
Or graphic novels, or a TV show, or a video game. There are video games that are becoming movies, and graphic novels that become TV shows, and TV shows that become films. It all works, but to think that you can create a world, like, say, The Lord of the Rings, where it's going to be so enticing that it's going to work on all these different levels, that's an incredibly difficult proposition. It's hard.
I know, that's why it's fascinating.
No, because it won't work.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What has gotten into you two this week? For
Pete's
sake.
Having fun.
Unbelievable.
Oh, but we always go offline later and say, I love you. I love you too.
Well,
I've seen this for decades, and I think it's just completely backwards. Create the great property, and then it can work in multiple platforms, yes. But you can't set out to create something that will work on 17 platforms. It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, it will be interesting to see what winds up happening and what comes out of this deal.
Ooh, if only the Grinch movie had also been a TV show.
Well, that kind of wraps us up, and we appreciate you sitting through all of our our audio issues with Michael sounding a little bit deeper than usual. And a little bit further away.
He doesn't to me. He sounds normal.
He sounds normal? Okay. Well, maybe it's just me then on my end. But
you sound like you're in a tin can.
I am actually not in a tin can. I am at Shea Betty in Park City, Utah. And once again, thank you to them for allowing me to record this week's podcast in their restaurant. ShaeBetty.com is the website to look up. The website to look up for our show notes is showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all of our social networking accounts like YouTube, where I will be posting video from Sundance, and Facebook and Twitter, where you can find out apparently rumors of Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie splitting up.
Which are not true, yes.
You can also find ways to email us. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND is the number to call. Again, that's 888-567-7263. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each podcast is by the popular indie rock group Management, or MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com, or on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT. Michael Giltz can be found, not in absentia, but on Michael Giltz. On michaelgiltz.com, also on Twitter, @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. Karen Woodward is on Twitter. @Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. Her writing can be found on KarenWoodwardOnline.com. Some of my writing can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. As well, I can be found on Twitter. @Sperling is the username to look up. I will be back in Los Angeles at the end of the week. So until next week, play nice.